Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. The European Space Agency has launched an ambitious new project to build a sat-nav and communication satellite network in orbit around the moon. The new infrastructure could one day turn our natural satellite into the eighth continent as humanity spreads its wings and builds cities on the lunar surface. ESA says the project, known as Moonlight, will support the Lunar Gateway space station, multiple agencies working on moon missions and human exploration. You can read more in the In the News section up at coasttocoastam.com. And just a reminder, tonight, Saturday night into Sunday morning on Coast, George Knapp speaks with Donna Francart, who was a deputy coroner who worked medical death investigations, which are those involving suspicious, violent, unexplained, or unexpected deaths. Francart turned to journaling as a way of privately unpacking the profound grief she faced and preserving her own mental well-being. And again, she joins George Knapp to talk about her new book, I've Seen Dead People, along with the conundrums she faced in her profession of perplexing relationships with both the living and the dead. And then in the second half, in 2016, a peculiar pyramid-shaped UFO was witnessed over the Welsh village of Pentridge. What's claimed to have followed was shocking. Military intervention resulting in the alien spacecraft crashing into woodland on the outskirts of this town in Wales. Laura and Eric Roughton from the UK, creators of the Paranormal Scholar, we'll discuss how, in the years since this happening, information related to the Pentridge UFO incident has been suppressed, leading some to believe it was one of the greatest UFO mysteries of all time. That's tonight, Saturday night into Sunday morning on Coast to Coast with your host, George Knapp. Back to your calls, questions, and comments, and more of my discussion on Giants, Gods, and Dragons with Derek Gilbert when Coast to Coast AM continues. Derek, sometimes it can be difficult to discern when we're to take the Bible literally or when it's kind of allegorical. When the Bible talks about dragons, are we talking about literal dragons, like, again, going back to J.R.R. Tolkien's, Lord of the Rings and fire-breathing, winged serpents and this sort of things?
Well, we're dealing with supernatural entities, so the answer to the question would be yes and no. Satan is described as a seven-headed dragon in Revelation chapter 12. We've got Leviathan, this chaos monster that is described likewise as a multi-headed dragon. But interestingly, we've got similar images that go back more than 2,000 years before John wrote the book of Revelation. This story about chaos that we had discussed before the break, with a warrior god having to defeat a chaos monster or chaos dragon in order to create the natural order of things. There's been a piece of artwork found from around the region of ancient Akkad, which is near Baghdad in Iraq, showing the warrior god Ninurta defeating a seven-headed serpent. So this is a very old image. I mean, think about that. That's more time between that creation of this little piece of art and John writing Revelation as between, you know, John and us having this conversation, you know, John writing Revelation and this program. So it's a very, very old image. It was inspired by something. And when I look at the Bible and start thinking, well, how can any of this be real? Well, it begins with the eyewitness testimony of the apostles, who made a point of telling those who they witnessed to after the resurrection of Jesus, yeah, we saw that. We were witnesses. In fact, Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, writing to the church at Corinth, pointed out that the risen Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, had been seen by hundreds of people, some of whom had fallen asleep, meaning they died, but many of whom were still awake. This is 20 years after the resurrection. In other words, he was telling them, go to Jerusalem and ask around, because there are witnesses who will tell you that what I'm saying about this guy who came back from the dead is true. So if Jesus affirms that this stuff is true, like, okay, well, we may not perceive it in the way we would think. We're not going to see it with our natural senses necessarily, but yeah, I would say that they are real. And in fact, the obvious dragons like Leviathan, like the Antichrist, like Satan in the Bible. Those are easy to point out, but we also make a point of digging into the Hebrew text in, for example, Numbers chapter 21, where the Israelites are plagued by fiery serpents. They're bitten by fiery serpents. That's the incident where Moses has to create a bronze serpent on a pole and lift it up so that the plague would be stopped. But the word, the phrase translated fiery serpent is actually Seraphim ha-Nachashim. And Nachash is the word translated serpent in Genesis 3. So the serpent in the garden was a Nachash, but it's used in conjunction with Seraphim in Numbers chapter 21. And then Isaiah later also writes about flying fiery serpents. So you've got this interchangeability of the word for serpent and Seraphim in the Bible. Well, we know from Isaiah chapter 6, the Seraphim are these entities around the throne of God with six wings, strange angelic-type creatures. Yet they're described in English and apparently understood by the Hebrews as fiery serpent. So flying fiery serpent, it sounds to me like the Seraphim are essentially dragons.
All right, let's go to the phones, and we'll begin on the wild card line. David is in Columbus, Ohio. David, good morning. Welcome to Coast AM.
Yes, sir. In the past 2 hours, you've been talking about all these gods from Mars, Pluto, Zeus, or whoever, that these ancient people stupidly prayed to. I think back to the Ten Commandments, right after Ramesses' son has died. He comes out and puts his arms, or his son, in the arms of some metal object, thinking this object is going to bring his kid back to life. You know what I mean? On the one hand, you got to feel sorry for the guy. And now on the other hand, you just got to think how stupid these people are to pray these things.
All right, David, thank you for that. Derek, did you want to respond?
Well, I think the thing to understand about the idols that the pagans of the ancient world prayed to is that they weren't praying to the block of wood or the carved stone. Those gave locality to the god that they were praying to. In other words, it was sort of like a supernatural or spiritual radio tuner. You know, okay, this idol here represents Baal, but that's not Baal. I'm not praying to this little piece of metal here, but that gives him locality, so I know where to pray to, essentially. That was the way the ancient Mesopotamians, the people around ancient Israel, understood the spirit realm. And that's why God said, you shall have no graven images. He was saying to them, we don't do that, okay? I'm not going to come down and inhabit that little block of wood or this piece of metal that you carved in some kind of image. God is omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent. He's everywhere. He's every when. And there are a number of things in the book of Leviticus that are direct responses to things that the pagans around ancient Israel were doing. And the prohibition of graven images was one of those.
All right. Let's say hi to Ira in Des Moines. Ira, good morning. Welcome.
Hey, I really appreciate you taking my call, Richard. You're filling some legendary shoes very well, and I appreciate you doing
Thank
the show.
Thank you.
On to Derek, and right quick, before I get to my actual question, regarding the Seraphim and the six wings, do you not think that that can represent or be allegorical to the toroid field and possibly two inverted tetrahedrons when it comes to energy and onto dragons and ley lines and going on to Chinese medicine, the seven chakras, so on and so forth?
I'll be honest with you. No, I actually think it's Isaiah wrote down what he saw, which was an angel, an angelic being with six wings. There are some skeptics who will say, no, he was describing the uraeus, which was a type of cobra that was used as a symbol of protection by the Egyptian pharaohs.
The Erebus, correct.
Yeah. The Egyptians had a lot of influence in the southern kingdom of Judah during the time of Isaiah and Hezekiah. But I think Isaiah wrote down what he saw. He was carried up to the throne room of God. He had a vision, and that's what he saw. To be honest, as far as the metaphysical aspects of ley lines and so forth, I've not done any research on that. I've kind of had my head in ancient Israelite and Mesopotamian cosmology the last few years.
And thank you. I appreciate you responding to that. I had to get that out of the way. Beings of fire, so on and so forth, and the Seraphim. Mm-hmm. I had to address that. And this is the actual question. A few years back, I'm a grown man of 40, graduated college, took a study abroad trip to Israel and Jordan, saw Petra, saw the cliff dwellings, went to the Dead Sea, saw the caves of Qumran, been there. And the one thing that stuck out the most, outside of the fact that your typical archaeological science, the way they tell you, is far, far more ancient than they're actually going to say it is regarding the ruins. In Jerusalem, it was filthy. I can't describe the feeling when you walk around. It feels sticky. It's just nasty. And why is it such a nexus point for human affairs there in Jerusalem, Israel, that everything seems to be, whether it be political, whether it be sociopolitical, socioeconomic, everything seems to go back to Jerusalem, Israel, the Mediterranean, the Tigris, Euphrates? What is it? What is it over there?
That is the center of it all. That is the location of the Har Moed, which is the Hebrew phrase translated Mount of Assembly or Mount of the Congregation. We also see that phrase in Isaiah chapter 14, which is the famous chapter, How art thou fallen, O Lucifer, son of the morning? He wants to establish his own Mount of Assembly at in the far reaches of the north, or the heights of the north, or the sides of the north. That is a reference to Mount Tzafon, Yarkate Tzafon, which is, again, a clue that we may be looking at Satan in Isaiah chapter 14, the five I wills, ascending above the heights of the clouds, making myself like the Most High. But again, the key is that the Mount of Assembly, Isaiah 14, 13, Har Moed, is the Hebrew phrase from which John writes, or John gets Armageddon. There's a problem in transliterating one of the Hebrew characters there in Moed, which is it's called the Ayin, which is like a reverse apostrophe. There's no corresponding sound in Greek or English. So the problem of transliterating that Hebrew phrase into Greek forced John to use the gamma. And English translators assume gamma, okay, that's a G sound. That's like he must have meant a Hebrew gimel. No, that's where you get the idea that the final battle will be fought at Megiddo, Har Megiddo. There's no mountain at Megiddo. Har Moed, it's the Mount of Assembly, God's Mount of Assembly, Zion, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. That's why all of the anger, all of the hostility is focused there. We were on the Temple Mount, in fact, back in 2019 during our tour of Israel that year, during Ramadan, interestingly enough. Very peaceful at the time. Not so much anymore, and it really won't be peaceful for any extended period of time until after Armageddon.
All right, Ira, thank you. Great questions. So speaking of Armageddon, this final battle, we hear about a king from the north coming down, and some people say, that must be Russia. Just walk us through that.
Yeah, that's the assumption based on the reading of Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39. And the coalition that comes against Israel in those days, that really wasn't a popular idea until the Scofield Bible, 1909, and then it gained popularity with the rise of the Bolsheviks leading up to and after World War I. Suddenly, oh, yes, okay, that must be the evil enemy. And the idea that, let's see, Ezekiel 38, verse 1, Son of man, set your face toward Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him, etc. There are some translations that will translate the word chief as Rosh, and Rosh, the Hebrew word Rosh means chief or head, but they will take that as, that must be a reference to a place called Rosh. That must mean Russia. I dealt with that in my book, Last Clash of the Titans. That is, there was no people group, no place name that would have been familiar to Ezekiel's readers in the 6th century B.C. by the name of Rosh. And again, the idea really wasn't popularized until about 100 years ago. But the idea is that goes along with what Isaiah, or rather Ezekiel, wrote about coming from the uttermost north. And again, that phrase, uttermost north, is the same phrase that I mentioned previously in Isaiah chapter 14, referring to this Mount of Assembly of the rebel that Isaiah was writing about, presumably Satan, the rebel kicked out of Eden. Yarkate Tzafon, that's that reference to that mountain in Turkey, Jebel al-Akra, near ancient Antioch. So we argue that this is not a reference to Russia coming from the uttermost north. And I know when you look at a map from Jerusalem, you can't get any further north on a map than Russia. This is a reference to cosmic or supernatural north, this rebel or fallen angel mount of assembly in Turkey. And in fact, when you read and study where the people were that Ezekiel refers to, Meshach, Tubal, Beth Togarma, Gomer, all of those people were known in Ezekiel's day as groups of people, nations in what is now Turkey. So, yeah, it probably is a geographic reference, but I don't think it's Russia. Russia will be a part of the coalition. When you take Ezekiel 38 and 39, the Gog-Magog War, in the context of all the apocalyptic prophecies in the Old Testament, like Zechariah 12, Zechariah 14, the whole world is coming to do battle at Armageddon, not just this group from the north led by Russia.
All right, let's say hi to Mark in Birmingham, Alabama. Mark, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Morning. How y'all doing?
Well, thank you.
Well,
good. Good. Well, first thing I want to say, these false gods, okay, yes, there were images. That was the motility, he says, of these gods. But they were formations in men's minds. That's why God referred to himself as the living God. Those gods were not living. They were just imaginary myths, okay? But anyway, as far regarding Apollyon and Abaddon, the destroying angel, okay, he's the pale rider. He is the one who flew over Egypt and extracted the life out of the first sons, including the Pharaoh's son, of those who did not swab their doors with the posts with the blood of the lamb, an unblemished lamb. Okay, so and he's described at Proverbs 8. It's about the eighth chapter 8, and it's about the eighth verse, and it says this. It says, "In the beginning was I brought forth, before his works of old or the earth was, before he laid the fountains of the deep or established the fountains of the deep, before he set the dust upon the hills, was I brought forth, and I was daily his." Delight always dancing before him, and my delights were with the sons of men. And then towards the end it says, blessed is he who waits at the posts of my doors. He who finds me finds life. Okay, and then if you go to Revelations 3 and 14, okay, and you start at about 11, it's referring to Jesus Christ, and it says the beginning of the creation of God. So he was given all power and authority in heaven, and he created all things after himself until it's all done at the end. And then he will sit at the right hand of God and hand all power and authority back to his Father.
Okay, Mark, I've got to take a time out here because we're approaching the bottom of the hour. But when we come back, I will get Derek to refer to or to respond to that first part of the question, which is interesting, the idea that these pagan gods were imaginary and that there was only one true living God. Back with more here on Coast to Coast AM. So, Derek, before the break, we had a gentleman caller from Birmingham, Alabama, Mark, I think his name was, and was, I guess, challenging the idea that these pagan gods were real. And he said that, it's clear in the Bible there was only the one living God. That means all the rest were just, legends. How do you respond?
Well, that's a danger that we have in basing all of our understanding of the Bible on the English translation, because the English doesn't always convey the sense of the underlying Hebrew, Aramaic, or Greek. As I said the first hour, one thing to remember is that the word Elohim in Hebrew refers to denizens of the unseen realm, spirit beings. Every time that word appears in the Old Testament, Elohim or a contraction of it, like Elohe or Elim, which is a contraction of the plural, it refers to spirit beings. It never refers to anything other than. There are other words in Hebrew that refer to the carved images that represented the idols. That represented the gods, that is. But we see in multiple places in the Old Testament, for example, Exodus 15, Moses says, "Who is like you, O Yahweh, among the gods, among the Elim?" David in Psalm 58, verses 1 and 2, "Do you indeed decree what is right, you Elim, you gods?" Another psalm, Psalm 89, Who among the heavenly beings, the B'nai Elim, or sons of God, is like Yahweh? God's first commandment, which Mark alluded to, you shall have no other gods before me. God specifically calls them Elohim. And again, in Psalm 82, which reads like a courtroom scene in heaven, God takes his place in the divine council. Elohim takes his place in the divine council. In the midst of the Elohim, the gods, he holds judgment. And then in verse 6 of Psalm 82, I said, you are gods, you are Elohim, sons of the Most High, all of you. Nevertheless, like men you shall die and fall like any prince. I know that most of us, I was certainly raised this way, that to believe that the pagans of the ancient world were worshiping the equivalent of imaginary friends, but God in the Bible himself calls them gods, and to read the Hebrew text, the Old Testament, any other way is to tell Hebrew speakers, Jews, that they don't know their own language. That's just the way it is.
All right. Well, I think that's pretty crystal clear, that case that you've made. Let's say hi to Sue in North Carolina, east of the Rockies. Hello, Sue. Good morning.
Yes, hello. What a wonderfully interesting thing you've got going on tonight.
Thank you.
My question is, Revelation 13, they talk of the beast out of the sea. Then they talk about the beast out of the earth. And my question is, in Revelation 19, they talk about the rider on the white horse. I was wondering, is that rider on the white horse the same first horse of the first horseman? And also, I'm very confused about when they speak of the beast and the king of the world, the kings of the world, what beasts are they referring to? And also the beast and the false prophet they speak of. This kind of confuses me as to who this beast is that they're talking about.
Well, it is confusing, and clearly it's something to remember when we're looking at end times prophecy, is that this is essentially foretelling the final war of the ages, God against the gods, these small g gods, these fallen angels. God of the God of the Bible, being the greatest general in all of in all of history, is not going to reveal all of his plans to the enemy just yet. So we are not going to see it all clearly until we can look at it as an event in the past. To answer your first question, the rider in Revelation 19, the rider on the white horse, is not the same rider on the white horse as in Revelation 6. The key, again, is looking at the original language. The crown that the rider, the first rider of the apocalypse, the rider in Revelation 6, that first rider, he's wearing a crown called a Stephanos. A Stephanos, that was a victory crown. It was a crown made of laurel leaves. And that's one of the clues that Sharon and I looked at and identifying that as the entity called Apollo. In Greek mythology, Apollo is the one who invented the Stephanos. And he, like the rider on the white horse, was an archer, a plague god who spread disease with his arrows. The bow is called a toxon. That's the only place in the Bible that Greek word toxon is used. It's the word from which we get toxic, which hints, again, that he's using it to spread unwellness, disease, illness. The rider in Revelation 19 wears a diadem, diademos in Greek. That's a crown of royalty. That's the big difference between the two. He is, that is the Messiah. That is Jesus Christ returning, not the same as the rider on the white horse. The other beasts, yeah, take some untangling, but the beast from the sea in the beginning of Revelation 13, that's the Antichrist, the beast from the earth, that is the false prophet. There are some who would identify that as Behemoth. If you take the first beast, the beast from the sea, the Antichrist as Leviathan, this other one, some suggest is Behemoth. I don't have an opinion on that one.
All right. Thank you for the call. And let's say hi to, we're going from North Carolina to South Carolina. Mark on the wildcard line. Good morning, Mark. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning for me, Chris and Derek. Thank you for taking my call. There's signs of, at least this is what was taught to me. I mean, I'm a Christian. I'm a believer. But the Bible was passed down by oral tradition, and that's where I got in Western civilization. Everybody, every parent fears that class because in college, because a lot of the you know, they say, well, this doesn't mean that, this doesn't mean that. So I know Derek is I mean, it's really interesting. And that's why I wanted to call in, approaching a lot of these issues with the allegorical things and the meanings behind them. My question, and I really have two-part question, is there in Revelation, I think there's seven seals that are broken, and as far as the plagues and stuff like that. And then the first part of that question is, a lot of this stuff was written back, you know, thousands of years ago, and are we in pre-apocalyptic times in the interpretation of the literal and the allegorical parts of the Bible, or are we in post times of the allegorical and literal meaning of the Bible? Because we might be living in the 1,000 years of destitute right now. That's one of my questions.
There are different ways of looking at it. There are those who believe that in an amillennial view of prophecy, which means there is no literal 1,000-year millennial reign. Sharon and I are definitely premillennial. We are also pre-tribulational, but we have a slightly different view of the pre-tribulation rapture, the timing of it, than many others. We believe that the first 5 seals of Revelation have already been opened, that they were opened in the first century when Jesus arrived in the throne room of God, which John witnessed in Revelation 4. We see in the book of Acts a couple of references and other references throughout the letters of the apostles that Jesus is already in heaven at the right hand of the Father, and the Lamb who was slain in the book of Revelation takes the scroll from the Father and begins opening the seals. So it's clear that Jesus was there in the first century. I mean, the most notable case is Stephen, when he's being stoned, looks up and sees Jesus at the right hand of the Father. So we believe the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse have been riding for 2,000 years. The 5th seal that was opened is the souls under the altar crying out, "How long, O Lord?" So the next event on the prophetic timeline is the great earthquake, the sixth seal, of Revelation 6, which we believe coincides with the rapture of the church. And this is based on a book by a friend of ours about 15 years ago called Earthquake Resurrection, David W. Lowe. Got to give him credit for that, for kind of reframing our paradigm in end times prophecy. He argues in that book, and argues convincingly, that the energy release of literally billions of souls being resurrected all at once will cause this great earthquake that literally makes the earth, as Isaiah puts it, real like a drunkard. We think that's next on the prophetic timeline.
All right. Thank you for that. Let's move along now. Robert is in Buffalo. Good morning, Robert.
Yes, good morning, Richard, and good morning, Derek. Thank you for taking my call. I'm about the sequence of events of our eschatology or the latter days. And Richard, you brought up the Battle of Armageddon, and Derek, I think you threw in there the Battle of Gog and Magog. I believe those two battles are two different battles. They're not the same thing. And furthermore, there's been preachers saying that the Battle of Gog and Magog is going to come any day now, since back in 1980, 40 years ago, I think Jack Van Impe was saying that. I think Pat Robertson's been saying it. And, you know, no mark on them. This is all a big puzzle that, you know, we're laboring to get the whole picture of it. But I do not believe that it does not even apply to our time when you're talking about the Battle of Gog and Magog. And I think that can be shown if you read the chapter before it, 37th chapter of Ezekiel. It's talking about he's resurrected all of the true Israel and put them in the land of Israel. David is reigning over the people as a prince, and the people of Israel are in a relationship with God, and their tabernacle, the Lord's tabernacle, is among them, and his sanctuary. Two things at the end of the 37th chapter of Ezekiel are among them, and they're in a relationship with God. That's not the case right now in Israel. Furthermore, it says that Gog and Magog are going to come down upon cities of unwalled villages. Well, right now, Israel has a wall about them, so it's not the time now. But let me propose an answer to what time the battle of Gog and Magog shall come. And if you look to the 20th chapter of Revelation, we won't go to it now, but just mark it down, the 20th chapter of Revelation, Gog and Magog are mentioned. At the end of the millennial reign, the devil should be loosed out of his pit, and he's going to go forth and deceive the nations for a final climactic deception attempt. And Gog and Magog are going to go up and surround the city, the camp of God, and fire is going to come down and destroy them.
Okay, Robert, I hate pardon the interruption, Robert, but time is tight here, so I just want Derek to respond to that. Gog and Magog, a different battle than Armageddon. Your thoughts, Derek?
No, it's the same battle. Ezekiel 39, verse 7, God appears on the battlefield himself in the battle of Gog and Magog. And my holy name I will make known in the midst of my people Israel, and I will not let my holy name be profaned anymore. And the nation shall know that I am Yahweh, the Holy One in Israel. That's the only place in the Old Testament that phrase is Holy One in Israel. Every other place, it's the Holy One of Israel. Then you go further down in Ezekiel 39, beginning at verse 17. God tells Ezekiel to prophesy to the birds of every sort and all the beasts of the field, basically inviting them to a really gruesome sacrificial feast where they shall eat flesh and drink blood, eating the flesh of the mighty, drink the blood of the princes of the earth, etc. That's the same feast described in Revelation chapter 19 following the Battle of Armageddon. Gog and Magog come back, but that's because they're supernatural. We're not looking at natural enemies. They are supernatural enemies. Gog of the Old Testament is the Antichrist.
All right. Thank you for that, Robert. Let me see if I can squeeze in one or two more here. Andy's in Norwalk, California. Andy, time is tight, so get right to your question if you could, sir.
Yeah, great show once again. Yes, two things. Number one, you know, the Bible says one generation shall not pass from the budding of the new nation of Israel to the second coming of Jesus Christ. If that statement is true, which I believe it is, time is getting very short. Obviously, and the stage and all the players of the world seem to be coming together for this coming world government. Now, this World Economic Forum says 2030 is their target date. Do you believe that, number one, that this organization is satanically inspired? And number two, do you believe that something very, very big, either a world depression or a serious war or drought, famine, call it what you will, has to happen in order to get enough countries to come on board and give up everything, all their freedom and liberties in order to be taken over by this beast? Thank you.
Yes, and I'm not going to set a date and say 2030 is a timeline, but everything in this world, if you look at it from a Christian perspective and you believe what the Apostle Paul wrote, we're not wrestling against flesh and blood, human opponents, but against principalities and powers and cosmic rulers over this present darkness. In other words, just as the disciples and the apostles understood in the first century AD, the early church understood the gods of the pagans, the gods of the Romans and the Greeks and the Canaanites and the Phoenicians, they were real, but they're fallen angels, but they do affect what happens in the natural world that we can perceive with our senses. And to your second question, yes, what's happened over the past year has been somewhat traumatic, some much more so than for others. But when that day comes, when the world is crying out for a global savior, it will look like this, but a lot worse.
All right. Let's see. Let's try to squeeze in one more quick one. Jason's in Olympia, Washington. Jason, get right to your question if you could. Do we have Jason?
Hi, Richard.
Hi there. Go ahead, Jason.
And really appreciate what you guys do for us here on Coast to Coast. Richard, you have a great taste in music, my friend.
Thank you.
And I have a quick question for Derek. In regards to the Nephilim, I was a young boy with my grandfather, who was a Jewish man, and we used to stay up late talking about the stories that he knew, and I was curious if your guest tonight knew about the story of Noah where ancient Nephilim was aboard Noah's ship when Noah took pity upon that Nephilim. And that was a story that was told to me as a young boy. And I'm just curious if Derek knew about that.
I've heard that story. That was Og of Bashan, who was the king of the land around Mount Hermon in the days of Moses. Moses and the Israelites made his kingdom the first military target of their campaign to take Canaan. Og of Bashan, and the book of Deuteronomy says his book is four cubits and a span or something to that effect. Essentially, it's like 13 feet long. What's interesting about it's like 6 cubits by 4 cubits, dimensions of his bed. What's interesting about that, and I think even more interesting, I don't think Og was actually 13 feet tall, nor do I think he was necessarily a descendant of the Nephilim, but an inscription found from the temple of Marduk, the chief god of Babylon, shows that the dimensions of Og's bed match exactly the dimensions of the cultic bed in the temple of Marduk, where it was believed that the chief god of Babylon came down every year during the New Year's festival and had ritual sex with his consort to bless the land. I think the mention of Og's bed is Moses connecting Og to the occult wickedness of Babylon.
All right. We'll have to leave it right there. Jason, thank you for the question. Derek, thank you for spending 3 hours. That's a marathon. And how do we get a copy of Giants, Gods, and Dragons?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. It's available at Amazon, all major booksellers. But the best deal on the book, because it includes a bunch of video teachings by Sharon and me, is at SkywatchTVStore.com. That's SkywatchTVStore.com.
Derek, all the best. Thank you. All right, for George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyons, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Donna Walker, Chris Burrows, Sean Latasore, and in Brantford, Ontario, Scott Park, I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. Until next time, so long for now.